Welcome back to our study of the Law of Moses. Over the last few months, we have looked at a really broad range of topics. All right, so we've looked at land laws, property laws, slave laws, laws concerning debt, laws concerning violence, a really wide range of things over the past several weeks. And a lot of that material has been building up to today's study. So it's all going to be tied together in this one person referred to in the Hebrew scriptures as the Goel. Because if you think about it, all of those laws, you know, pertaining to land, property, slaves, debt, violence, all of those laws point to trouble, ultimately. What do you do if you wind up in debt? What do you do if you lose your land, if you lose your home? What do you do if you wind up enslaved? What do you do if someone murders your husband and leaves you without any kind of provider? It's all basically one question. Who's got your back? And in antiquity, it's almost always family. Remember, in antiquity, and really up until very recently, there's no police force, and there's minimal government. All you have is family. They're the ones that have your back. Now, we know from relatively recent history how badly that can play out. The Hatfields and McCoys story has played out thousands of times over the course of human history. You have one person who wrongs another person, and it can be really anything. But it leads to this kind of back and forth and this bickering that ultimately, you know, you have one family retaliating against the other, and eventually somebody gets killed. And their blood has to be avenged. And then whoever dies to avenge the other one's blood also has to be avenged. And it just creates this vicious cycle. And it ends up becoming the stuff of legend, you know, tragedy, like the Hatfields and McCoys. You can also consider the financial side of things. People don't want to give each other money. Sometimes even family can be stingy, right? Bad financial situations can create all kinds of friction within a family. I think it's a fairly common experience. All of this is why the Law of Moses formalizes the way in which you are supposed to care for your family. And it does that through this figure that the law calls the Goel, or the Redeemer. It is the Goel's job to bail family members out of financial trouble, to get the family land back, to buy people out of slavery, to avenge murders. And the law sets some hard limits on what the Goel must do on the one hand, and what he can and cannot do on the other hand. Now, at this point, we've not really specified who the Goel is relative to you. That's something that we're going to pick up along the way as we read from the law. But a common English rendering of this Hebrew word Goel is kinsman redeemer. So it's someone who is related to you, some member of your family. Now we're going to continue to use the word Goel, though, because it's used in a somewhat, I think, broader sense than the English word redeemer covers. Redeemer is a good word for it, though, especially as we consider the things that we're going to look at today. We're going to focus mainly on the financial trouble today, and then next week we're going to spend our time talking about blood vengeance, which the Goel also has a part in. And there he is referred to, again, as the Goel of blood. Redeemer, again, the English word redeemer doesn't quite fit so well there. So we're going to refer to him as the Goel, just so that we get that full range of meaning. And it gives us something of like a formal title to understand this guy by. So let's start with the Goel's redemptive roles. Two of these are covered in the Jubilee laws of Leviticus chapter 25. The first is in verse 25. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer, that is, his nearest Goel, shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. All right, so as we have seen in past classes, the inheritance of the promised land is supposed to be eternal. The land is supposed to stay in the clan forever. And the Goel is the human agent who helps ensure that the land stays in the clan forever, since one of his jobs is to redeem sold land. Now, this might raise the question, all right? So you're looking at the situation where a brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, and you might ask yourself, well, why not just have the Goel support his kinsman before the kinsman has to resort to selling his land? That's a good question. And I think the text of the Jubilee Laws in Leviticus 25 is supposed to make us think along those lines. That's why it includes a provision later on in the chapter, beginning in verse 35. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan, and to be your God. Now, the Goel is not mentioned explicitly in that text. But I want you to consider the logic of the chapter. Israel, the text is inviting Israel to put two and two together here. By the time that you hear what we've just read in verses 35 through 38, you know, that you should take care of your poor brother, that you should give him food, not looking for profit, not looking for gain, loan, you know, not at interest. By the time that you hear that, you've already heard verse 25. That if someone has had to sell their land, that it's the job of the nearest redeemer to come in and redeem it. All right, so if you're somebody who's in that kind of position, where you are, you know, you're a patriarch in your clan, and you know there are other male relatives that you have living around you, and you know, all one of them is starting to have a little bit of trouble, and you know ultimately where things are going to tend, right? How things are going to end up. You know, you either get to take care of your close relative now, or you potentially get to spend a whole lot more money later on taking care of him after he has lost his land. And so it makes sense to start taking care of your relative now and not letting that kind of situation crop up. So that's one obligation that the Goel has, is to redeem land that has been sold outside of the clan. The Jubilee Laws describe another obligation that the Goel has, and it also tells us who the Goel is. So if you go down just a little bit later in Leviticus 25, we'll start in verse 47. If a stranger or sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor, and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you, or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he has sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle or his cousin may redeem him, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him, or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. All right, so first off, the Goel is identified. The Goel is simply a close relative. And Leviticus kind of takes us through this. It's kind of like a chain of succession here. Starts with brothers and then moves on to uncles and cousins and then just basically whoever the closest living relative is. The law, again, is basically calling on nearest of kin, an idea that we still use in law today. And so another one of the Goel's jobs is to redeem near kin from debt slavery. If some relative of yours gets sold into slavery, it's your job to go and pay off his debt to buy him out of slavery. And again, Israel is invited to put two and two together, right? You see someone in your clan struggling, and you know ultimately it is going to wind up in this situation where they have sold their land and ultimately sold themselves. And you know that the law really puts the impetus on you to bail them out of that situation. So better to take care of them now than wait until the problem is worse. So we can see the law establishing this principle. You are supposed to take care of your close family. This is a principle that we find carried over pretty much untouched, unchanged, in the New Testament. We read about this in 1 Timothy chapter 5. We'll read verses 3 and 4, and then verse 8. Honor widows who are truly widows. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. You look at the strong language that Paul has for a person that doesn't take care of their own kin, their own family. If someone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. I have been at pains over the course of this study to try to emphasize just how central all of this is to the law of Moses. Taking care of the poor, taking care of people in need, is absolutely central. It's one of the things that the prophets constantly harp on. Right? You're not taking care of the poor, you're not taking care of the widow, you're not taking care of the orphan. And this extends to family. Right? If someone is struggling, close family ought to be taking care of them, if they have close family. And Paul joins right in with the prophets in condemning the person who will not take care of the needy brother, as saying, you are so far gone that you have denied the faith. You are worse than an unbeliever. And that's why, by the way, you've got this singular figure, the Goel, held up as a redeemer. Right? We can't miss the obvious connection between that language and the language of the New Testament as it talks about Jesus. As we're studying through the Goel, consider all of this as backdrop for understanding what Jesus has done spiritually through the church. Right? And just as Israel was supposed to understand that they had been redeemed, they were to act as redeemers, so too the church is supposed to understand we have been redeemed, we are supposed to act as redeemers in our own lives. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, because one last thing that we should note from Leviticus 25, from all of the Jubilee laws, and we've only taken snippets here and there, go through and look at Leviticus 25. I think over the course of all of our classes over the last few weeks, we've read most of Leviticus 25 together. I want you to note that the Goel is the first line of defense if someone is sliding into poverty. If that fails, if there is no Goel, if no one steps up, then there are usually a couple of other lines of defense. But the final line of defense is always the law itself, the will of God as expressed through Moses. So long as Israel obeys God's will, there will always be a year of release. If all else fails, if no one is able to redeem the land, if no one is able to buy out their kinsman's debt so that they can leave debt slavery, if no one is able to do that, the year of Jubilee is the final line of defense. In that year, all of the land is supposed to be returned. All of the debt slaves are supposed to be released. Well, and honestly, the debt slaves are supposed to be released every seventh year anyway. Right, but you've always got the law itself as this final line of defense. God places himself, then, in the role of Goel. And that's something that we're going to continue to see in our study of the law. It's something that we see also pretty plainly in the Gospels. When you look at the Jubilee laws in Leviticus 25, God is constantly appealing to how he has already acted as Israel's Goel. He has redeemed the nation of Israel from Egyptian slavery. And since they used to live in slavery, and since they have been redeemed from slavery, they ought to sympathize with the plight of slaves. And they ought to act as redeemers themselves. Again, this same message is preserved, concept for concept, for the church today. We understand what it means to be enslaved to sin. We understand what it means to hold a debt to God that we cannot ever hope to pay. We understand what it means, what it feels like, to have been redeemed, because Jesus is our Redeemer. And understanding all of those things, we ought to have pity on those who are in debt, those who are enslaved, and we ought to act as redeemers in as much as it is in our power. That's, again, the basic lesson of 1 Timothy chapter 5 in the way that the church is to handle widows. So that is one redemptive role of the Goel, is buying things back, redeeming in that sense, buying back land and buying back people. The Goel also has another redemptive role, which is to raise up offspring in certain circumstances. In a true patriarchy, like you saw in antiquity, it is really hard to get by without a patriarch and without sons. In fact, it's almost impossible. And remember also that everything is handled through the patriarch, including inheritance. We've seen that the law allows daughters to inherit with certain restrictions. We saw that with the daughters of Zelophehad. But most inheriting is done through sons. And most importantly, the family name is inherited through sons. The name of the father's house is preserved through sons. The Hebrew scriptures show a great deal of concern for preserving the name of the father's house. So what do? If your husband dies before he can provide you with any sons. In the ancient Near East, it was common in such circumstances for a close male relative, usually a brother of the deceased, to step in and provide a son for his brother's widow. We see this happening in the Bible before the law of Moses is given. Turn to Genesis chapter 38. We'll start in verse 6. We'll just get a little bit of the story of Judah and Tamar. Genesis 38:6. And Judah took a wife for Er his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground, so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, so he put him to death too. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up." For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. All right, some extraordinary things going on in this story. Even in just in this short bit, the snippet of the story. You've got Er, who we don't even know what he does, but he's so bad that the Lord just strikes him down where he stands. So he's just dead. Again, we don't know exactly why. He's wicked. Then you have Onan, and we get to see his wickedness, and it really makes you wonder what Er did, but whenever you see Onan's wickedness, because the Lord responds to Onan in exactly the same way he responds to Er. You look at this arrangement, though, that is set up. Judah tells Onan, Er's younger brother, go into Tamar and perform the duty of a brother-in-law for her. And now this is before the law of Moses is given, so it's understood in the ancient Near East that this is just naturally the brother-in-law's job to preserve his brother's name, preserve his brother's inheritance, provide a son for his deceased brother. So Onan is supposed to impregnate Tamar, and the first son that they have together belongs to the deceased brother, to Er. And that son is going to receive a share of the inheritance. But that's the problem. There is this perverse incentive to not split up the inheritance any more than it already is. So as it is, you had these three sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. One of them has died. Now you have Onan and Shelah. And now, depending on how things are divvied up, it was looking like Onan was only going to receive 1/4 of the inheritance, because Aer was going to receive a double portion, right? So he was going to receive, the inheritance is going to be split into four parts. Aer is going to receive two parts, Onan receives one, Shelah receives one. Now Aer is dead, and I'm not exactly sure how this would play out, if the position of firstborn would then fall on Onan. Then he would really make out like a bandit. He would go from getting a 1/4 portion in the inheritance to getting a 2/3 stake in the inheritance. Then instead of splitting four ways, it's going to get split three ways, and Onan is going to get a double portion. Or even if he's not counted as firstborn, it's still going to be split in half. And half is a whole lot better than a quarter. All right, so Onan looks to at least double his share in the inheritance, probably more, so long as Aer does not have an heir. And so you read that he... Our English translator, the ESV's done a good job in translating this, because this is the sense of it. In the English, it tells us whenever he went into Tamar, he would waste the seed on the ground. We're supposed to understand this as a habitual thing. Onan had really gotten in good here. Not only was he expanding his share in the inheritance, but now he had a woman that he could use essentially as a sex toy. And so God strikes him down dead for it, which is precisely what he deserves. And Judah's reaction is just as astounding as anything else. Judah sees what has happened, and he decides that instead of performing his duty in making sure that Tamar is taken care of, making sure that she is given a son, he pawns her off on her father. Remain a widow in your father's house until Shelah, my son, grows up. Now, of course, what we know is that Judah has no intention of letting Shelah have a son by Tamar, because Judah fears that Shelah would die like his brothers. In other words, Judah's got it in his head that the reason his sons are dying is because this woman is bad news. Right? Tamar is damaged goods in some way. And it's sleeping with her that has caused his sons to die, not their wickedness. And so Judah conspires to keep Tamar a widow, completely defenseless, living in her father's house. Now, the way that this plays out is that Tamar ultimately has to take things into her own hands, and she deceives Judah and gets Judah to provide an heir for her. Excuse me. And all of this ends up with, again, Tamar having sons by Judah, and Judah repenting of the decision that he's made here in the text that we just read. And Judah's repentance at the end of Genesis 38 is what... It's what redeems him. It's what sets him up to be able to say the things that he says to Joseph in Genesis 44. Right, this is really the end of Genesis 38. The reaction to all of what happens with Tamar here is what sets Judah up to be a holy person over the rest of the book of Genesis. We see that this kind of situation did arise in the ancient world, and as we see with Onan, there's a lot of room for abuse in this kind of arrangement. Again, Onan has decided he's going to cut his brother off, and he's going to use his brother's widow as a sex toy. And so to try to prevent that kind of thing from happening, the law of Moses formalizes the requirement of the goel to raise up a son for his deceased brother. We read about this in Deuteronomy chapter 25, beginning in verse 5. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, The wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate of the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, "I do not wish to take her," then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. All right, so this, again, just like with, just like what we saw in 1 Timothy 5, you know, such a person has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Just like we saw in Genesis 38, so Onan did wickedly in the sight of the Lord, and so the Lord struck him down too. The punishment for failing to provide for your kin in this way is severe. All right, this one, and again, remember, this is a true patriarchy that we're talking about here. Right, we're not perfect by any means today. But by ancient standards, we live in an egalitarian society. We're not a true patriarchy today. Cast yourself back to a true patriarchy. The law enables a woman who has been wronged in this regard to drag her brother-in-law before the elders at the gate, to yank his sandal off his foot, and to spit in his face. And then, as a result of all of that, that brother's household has their name blotted out of the clan. They become known as the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. Just the deepest shame that you can imagine for not providing an heir for a deceased brother. We call this arrangement, by the way, leveret marriage, where a brother goes in and provides an heir for his deceased brother. I want you to notice here, as we've looked through Deuteronomy 25, that the concern here is similar to the concern in Leviticus 25, that each clan's inheritance be preserved in perpetuity. It ties together really closely with what we saw with the daughters of Zelophehad in Numbers chapter 36. Remember, they come before Moses, they bring this complaint that that their father has died, and he doesn't have any sons, and they don't want their father's name to be erased from Israel. And so God tells Moses, in those kinds of circumstances, you allow daughters to inherit, if a man dies with daughters but no sons. And then some other members of the clan come before Moses and say, well, hey, if these daughters marry off into another one of the tribes, then our inheritance that belongs to our tribe is going to end up going to the other tribes. And God steps in again and says, yes, they're right. The daughters of Zelophehad have to marry from within the clan. All right, so this is very similar. This is almost like a proto-leveret marriage that is prescribed for the daughters of Zelophehad, that they have to marry close relatives within their clan so that the land stays within the clan. Now, we should note here that Deuteronomy 25 does not use the term Goel, but we shall see that this redemption that we've read about in Deuteronomy 25 is connected to the other redemptive roles of the Goel. We're going to see how that takes place in the book of Ruth. That's where we're going to turn our attention now. We read from Ruth several weeks ago, when we talked about the protected classes and the poor laws. You'll remember that we saw Ruth fitting into all of the protected classes. She's a widow. She is a foreigner because she's from Moab. We're also given to believe that she is an orphan, since Naomi tells her to return not to her father's house, but to her mother's house. And so she is completely poor and defenseless. And we saw the great lengths that Boaz went to protect Ruth and to provide for her and to provide for Naomi. How Boaz goes above and beyond the requirements of the law. All right, so that was the first half of the book of Ruth. How Boaz is going above and beyond to provide food and to secure the rights of those who are poor, those who are among the protected classes in the law. The last half, one of the last things that we read in Ruth was Naomi telling Ruth that Boaz is one of their near relatives, one of their redeemers. And there we find our word goel again. Naomi explicitly identifies Boaz in Ruth chapter 2, verse 20, as a goel. And the last half of the book, chapters 3 and 4, develops that idea, develops how Boaz fills the role of goel. So we're going to go ahead and read the last half of Ruth together, chapters 3 and 4. So this will be a longer reading, but it'll be worth it. Ruth chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young woman you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment that you were wearing and hold it out." So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the redeemer, of whom Boaz had spoken, came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witness this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech, and all that belonged to Kilian and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went in to her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. The end. And it really deserves a the end, because this has got a storybook ending to it. It is absolutely wonderful. All of this starts with Ruth propositioning Boaz at Naomi's behest, and by her advice. Boaz accepts the potential responsibility of redeeming both Naomi, you know, the land that Elimelech has left behind, and Ruth. This again shows how greatly Boaz goes above and beyond what the law requires, because there's this closer relative who can act as Goel for Naomi and Ruth. Boaz is technically off the hook, and most men in the ancient world would have been relieved to discover that. Right? Most men in the ancient world would not want to act as Goel, particularly in regards to Ruth. Right? We saw it with Onan. Onan enjoyed getting to use Tamar, but absolutely did not want to raise up an heir for his dead brother, because it would hurt his own inheritance. That kind of perverse incentive is always still there. Right? There's a reason why Deuteronomy 25 leaves open the possibility that a man might accept this kind of great shame that would come upon him, and then refuse to raise up offspring for his dead brother, because it was seen as a major, major sacrifice. Boaz isn't this way, though. Boaz pursues the matter eagerly. He goes into this intending to become the redeemer, not just of Naomi's land, but also of Ruth. Now, as we've seen in the law, again, this redemption includes both Elimelech's land and his bloodline, and this closer relative is fine with redeeming the land. We should notice, by the way, that he's interested now in redeeming the land during a barley harvest where everything seems to be going great. Right? As we've read so far in the book, whenever Ruth goes out into Boaz's fields, there's plenty of grain there. Seems like the harvest is doing fine. This close relative sees an opportunity to add some to his harvest, because it's a good year. Where was this guy at the beginning of the book? This close relative who lived in the same town, where was he at the beginning of the book during the famine, whenever Elimelech felt required to move out of Israel, move to Moab. In the end, though, this guy objects to redeeming Elimelech's bloodline because he feels that it's going to jeopardize his own inheritance. So he, and you notice things have, as it's presented in Ruth, and this is kind of a curiosity, this is an oddity that I think is kind of outside the scope of this study, but you notice how things are a lot more sanitized in the account in Ruth. It is presented as just the way that business is done, that you draw off your sandal and you give it to somebody else, as an attestation that you are giving over some right or you were selling something. Not exactly sure what to make of it. Again, it's kind of outside the scope of things, but we cannot help but hear the echoes of Deuteronomy 25 in that, and how in the law, the widow who has been wronged by her brother-in-law pulls the sandal off of his feet and spits in his face in front of the elders at the gate. And he is dishonored for this refusal. Boaz goes in for both of these responsibilities eagerly. And the book ends with rich blessings for the faithfulness of Ruth and Boaz. They're blessed because both of them are faithful. Ruth is faithful in coming to Israel and in taking care of Naomi and in doing all of these things and essentially proposing to Boaz instead of going out and seeking somebody else to propose to. So her faithfulness is rewarded. Boaz's faithfulness is rewarded. They're given a son. And the book ends with quite a surprise because it turns out that Boaz himself is a descendant of Perez, one of the sons produced by Judah and Tamar in Genesis 38. And it's, by the way, this is the first time in the Hebrew scriptures that we see that full genealogy of Perez. We usually get the genealogy of Judah traced down through Hezron. We see it a few times earlier in the Law of Moses. But it's in Ruth, for the first time, we see it traced all the way down until we learn that it includes Boaz. Boaz himself. Boaz's very existence relies on kinsman redemption, which Judah initially was unwilling to fulfill. But of course, by the end, he does, because Tamar has taken things into her own hands, and he repents of his unwillingness, and he is, again, he's provided with these sons, specifically with Perez. And Boaz comes about as a result of that, and then he becomes a kinsman redeemer. And on top of all of that, this kinsman redemption leads to the birth of the great King David. It's just an absolutely stunning conclusion to this story. And honestly, reading through this, you hit this very last section at the end. It brings a tear to my eye, just at how poetically everything closes up. Because Boaz is doing precisely what the law calls on Israel to do. Boaz is the guy. He's the model, right? Not this other guy who, again, this other kinsman, we don't know who he is. His name's never mentioned, right? We're not supposed to be like that guy who's willing to go part way in the redemption, but not all the way. We're not supposed to be like, you know, this guy that gets his sandal yanked off and gets his face spat on. We're supposed to be like Boaz, who doesn't just provide the bare minimum, but who goes above and beyond, and who pursues this redemptive role eagerly. All right, so that's the first half of our study of the Goel. Next week, we are going to consider the more grisly part of the Goel's duties, because the Goel is also the Goel of blood, as we'll see it expressed in other places in the law, in Numbers and in Deuteronomy. So that wraps us up for this week. We can't help but see, again, Jesus being foreshadowed, being proclaimed in all of these things. And it's no coincidence, by the way, and I can't believe I almost forgot to mention this. You look at the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, and both of these redeemed people, you know, this line of redemption is present there in the line of the Messiah himself, right? Perez is there, Obed is there, Boaz is there. And it's just, again, it's so poetic, it's so appropriate that the bloodline of the Redeemer would include so many redeemers and products of redemption. All right, the whole thing, it's all a story of redemption. And Jesus has come to fulfill all of that through his ministry, through his work. Where we have been left helpless, where we have been left without hope, where we have been left empty, Jesus has redeemed us and filled us and given us hope and a future. So, again, that wraps us up for this week. I hope that this week's study was edifying to you. Next week, we will pick up on blood vengeance, which, again, is grisly, also a whole lot of fun. So, look forward to seeing you then. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.